Support for The Front Porch comes from the Charleston Gazette-Mail, with two editorial pages, one conservative, one progressive, kind of like The Front Porch. Find it at wvgazettemail.com. On today's Front Porch, Senator Shelley Moore Capito talks about President-elect Trump and what the total GOP control of Washington means for West Virginia. We'll talk broadband, roads, healthcare, minor safety, and much more. Senator, welcome to The Front Porch. I understand you're coming off a little bit of a cold.
Just a little bit of a cold, but I feel good. I just sound worse, but it's still me here.
Okay, so we appreciate you coming here anyway. Thank you. We're also joined, as always, by Lori Lynn, our conservative columnist and lawyer, and liberal columnist Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
Hey there.
Senator, black lung disease is unfortunately making a huge comeback in Appalachia. This is according to a new investigation from NPR. Here's one miner we talked to who has the advanced version of black lung disease. His name is Mackie Branham, and he's just 39 years old.
Me, I've never been scared of death. It don't bother me a bit. It's just not seeing my kids grow up. But if I had it to do over, I would do it again, if that's what it took to provide for my family as long as I have.
Senator, what does Congress and the incoming Trump administration need to do to help these miners and prevent even more cases of black lung?
Well, I think early diagnosis seems to me one of the keys. I think that gentleman that we just heard is a young man. He's not an elderly miner that's been in the mines for 40 years. So I think the crux of the report that I read at NPR is that there's something maybe new happening here with our younger miners. I just met this week with probably 10 people who are afflicted with black lung who are concerned about the continuation of the benefit that they have now. And I'm certainly committed to that, have been, and will continue to be. And also for their widows, some of them meet early deaths because of this, and they're concerned about their families as they move on. And that's a concern I hold as well. I think that, you know, safer conditions are always something that we need to move forward on. MSHA just went forward with a lower coal dust standard. But I don't think we're going to be able to see, and that's also in the report that I read at NPR. We're not going to really see the results of that quite yet. But that's a human tragedy that we just heard, and it's sad. The sad part, I think, for all of us and for me as well, is when he states that he would do it all over again, even though he's struggling for breath. And I don't know that that's a situation that we want to keep enforcing, that that's what you're going to do everything no matter what. We shouldn't have that.
So on a related question, first, thanks for supporting the Miners Protection Act. I'm just curious what you think the prospects for that are in the coming year.
You know, I think they're good. I'm really disappointed, Rick, in the way the whole thing shook out in the end. You know, we've been pushing bipartisan, Senator Manchin, Senator Portman Brown from Ohio, the Pennsylvania senators, the Virginia senators, to try to get a permanent resolution to the health care and pension issue. And we, you know, Senator McConnell told us, he said, move it through regular committee. We did. And we got bipartisan, you know, not everybody was for it, but it was I think it was 18-6 or 18-8 vote. And then in the end, we couldn't push it any further than 4 months, which is a huge disappointment. And as I talked to those miners last week, they were disappointed. They did seem to understand that we can live to fight another day. So what we need to do is attack this earlier. McConnell did say on the floor of the Senate that he doesn't see any reason why this shouldn't be able to be taken care of. I couldn't believe they want to hear us fight about it again, and because we're going to have so much going on in the spring. So I'm optimistic, but cautiously so, because we've been optimistic before.
Senator, West Virginians voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, almost 69% more than any other state. So I think it's fair to say that expectations are high. What can West Virginians hope for from a Trump administration?
Well, I think expectations are high. I think that anytime a state votes 69%, particularly the way West Virginia has flipped over the years. When you look at, you know, Dukakis won West Virginia, it didn't used to be like this. And I think that West Virginians felt taken advantage of, overlooked, underappreciated, and really not as being a part of, over the last 8 years, haven't felt like they've been a part of this, you know, future for their children and their grandchildren. And it was reflected in everybody's vote. And I think President-elect Trump tapped into this, not just in West Virginia, but in a lot of different places. So I think people know that if we move, I think, in a reasonable fashion, he moves in a reasonable fashion to sort of unleash some of the regulations that are holding back some of our energy jobs. But I think we all realize it's not going to come back to where it is. And I don't think people who are in the business for many years believe that to be true, or miners. I think people want a fair shake. They want good education. They want to be able to live in a place that they love. And so I think it's not just a national challenge. I think it's a state challenge for the new legislature and the new governor as well. I think that President-elect Trump should try. This is hard for him to not overpromise, because I think that just will breed discontent quickly. My life's not changing. I don't feel any more hope than I did before. But I do think that the other message was, we're ready to shake it up, and we're going to risk. Maybe we don't like everything about this guy and maybe the way he presents certain things, but we're willing to risk this. Because the status quo hasn't worked for us, and Washington isn't working. So I think it's going to be a really interesting time to serve, and hopefully I find West Virginians to be optimistic about the future, maybe uncertain a little bit, like, what does that really mean, but feeling good about it.
You've been a big supporter of broadband internet access for rural areas. What are you asking the incoming administration and the new Congress to do to promote this?
This has turned into one of my most major issues. I have started this thing called Capito Connect, nice little ring to it. And I found that in the FCC, 56% of West Virginia doesn't have high-speed internet. So we're being asked to transition. Okay, we're going to accept that that's, and we probably should have been doing this 30 years ago. I think we all agree. But if we don't have one of the stools of infrastructure, such as broadband, we can't do it. So I just wrote a letter to President-elect Trump saying if he's going to do a big infrastructure package, which he's talked about a lot. Remember, he talks about how bad the airports are and the roads. And I think we can all agree. I just flew through Chicago a couple weeks ago. That is not a modern airport. You're laughing. It's not. LaGuardia is another one. I would say I'm asking him to include broadband as one of those pieces of infrastructure, particularly to the rural and underserved areas. It's easy to up the speeds in downtown Manhattan or even downtown Charleston, but it's not easy to get to Elkins or to Seneca Rocks or those areas or Fayetteville even, where you have a bustling tourism trade developing there. But guests want to be able to get their internet at their cabin at night when they go in, and so that's a real problem for them. So we're working on that, and also I think statistics are extremely important. Same thing with black lung. It's to me, you know, if you got statistics that are so disparagingly apart, we need to do a better job and do a more in-depth study. Same thing with broadband. We have statistics that say 90% of the state's connected. Well, you can go to Sissonville and get unconnected pretty easy out in Putnam County from here. I just talked to a guy on the airplane who moved here because he loves it here, but he has to get satellite service because he can't get broadband.
And you know, the history of government and technology is sometimes rocky in terms of waste and fraud. And what kind of safeguards do you see to make sure that if we're spending a lot of money on this, that the taxpayers' money is going to be spent wisely?
I think that's a great question. The stimulus package that President Obama put forward had a broadband component to it. In West Virginia, it turned into a joke. I mean, I think it was $140 million, and we had a chance there. And it was squandered, and so I think accountability is big. One of the things we've put forward is, for instance, through the Universal Service Fund, which everybody pays on their phone, instead of getting phone service to everybody, it's now going to be including broadband, to underserved and unserved areas. So we are asking for full and complete statistics. What happens is they have these census tracts, and if one person in the census tract has service, then they count in their account that everybody has service. And certainly the person nearest to the main line may have it, but not everybody else. So we need to have better statistics that way. So we're going to hold the feet to the fire there. And I think we need to get private investment into this. Kentucky's trying that right now. And they've had some stops and starts with their public-private partnership, I think. But that needs to be a part of it. I've talked to Google and Microsoft and some of the big players to try to, you know, incent them instead of connecting India and sub-Saharan Africa. Let's try West Virginia first. Or it's not just West Virginia. I started a broadband caucus. It's Minnesota. It's Arkansas. It's Maine. It's all over the place spots. So some of those are some of the things we've been doing.
We're going to take a quick break and then more with Senator Shelley Moore Capito on healthcare and President-elect Trump's cabinet picks. But first, you're listening to The Front Porch right now, and thanks for that. But if you're like me, you forget things all the time. So here's one way that you can make sure you don't forget The Front Porch. Subscribe. Subscribe to us in your podcast app. How you do it? You just open your podcast app, search for The Front Porch, and hit subscribe. And while you're there, you can also leave a comment that helps other people to find The Front Porch. Oh, when you subscribe to The Front Porch, make sure you don't end up on someone else's front porch. There are a few of us. Our front porch is a blue logo with two rocking chairs on the front. Thanks. Okay, we're back with Senator Shelley Moore Capito.
So another thing I'd like to thank you for, you've been a big supporter of like the Children's Health Insurance Program right from the beginning. You know, there's talk about repealing the ACA. In West Virginia, about 175,000 people have gained coverage by Medicaid expansion alone and other parts of it. I'm just wondering, is there a way to ensure that it's replaced and not just repealed?
I know that this is a huge question, and I've read your articles, and I know how deeply you feel about the expanded health care and the possibility of getting West Virginians not just covered but healthier at the same time. So Obamacare is going to be repealed. I mean, that's a slam dunk. We have a Republican Senate that is only going to need, because of a legislative mechanism, only 51 votes. And not the 60 vote for the filibuster, Republican Congress, and then now a Republican president coming in. There's no doubt he'll sign this. And what it will do is it will take down a lot of the guarantee. It will take down a lot of the taxes that are associated with Obamacare. It's the same mechanism, pretty close to what we used in 2015, that President Obama did not sign. In that is a transition for those. I'm concerned about the 175,000 West Virginians that have Medicare coverage. I want to see them get good coverage and better health outcomes, but I also don't want to see them wake up January 15th and say, well, that was nice for a year, but I now no longer have it. So we need a transition. So there's going to be a 2 to 3 year transition built in to try to build the best system that can continue coverage for those, probably involve more state involvement, maybe more state block grants where the state really says and formulates their own Medicaid program and has more direct influence on how they do that. So it's not fully formed, and that, I think, is where the trepidation comes in. Well, that sounds great, Shelley. You're going to take it down, but you're not telling us exactly what you're going to put in place, and I can't tell you right now what that would be. It also leaves in place things like you can't be cut off for pre-existing conditions. You can't be cut off of your parents before you're 26 if that's one of the provisions that helps your family. And the minor protection that we talked about, the presumption of black lung that is built into the ACA, would remain as well. So there are certain things in there that would not come down when we repeal it. And I think, you know, some Democrats who have just now, after post-election, some are saying we're not going to help, but some are saying we are going to help. And so here I am, ever optimistic. I think we can reach a place. It may not be the big, sweeping 3,000-page bill that Obamacare was, but it's going to be a replacement vehicle that's going to, I think, it's going to be better for everybody. And, you know, because the ACA has really hurt a lot of people, too, in terms of premiums going up, deductibles going up. I met a couple whose deductible is $15,000. Well, they just dropped it. They just pay the penalty. They both work. And so there are some penalties, some people that are really feeling it, businesses and others trying to help provide health care to their employees. Yeah.
Well, I just know that there's a huge economic impact too,
right.
And that affects our healthcare system and the people who work in it, which is one of the areas where we have growing employment.
Right.
Too. Now WVU Medical is the biggest employer in the state, I believe, bigger than Walmart. So it's, I've talked to people who say this is helping keep our ambulance going, our rural hospitals. So there's a whole lot riding on.
There is, but there are, if you talk to some of other like some of the hospitals in our rural hospitals, they're struggling because Medicaid traditionally underpays. Now, I would argue, and you would argue, I think the same thing. Well, something's better than nothing.
Right.
And it's not all uncompensated care. But the troublesome thing is we really haven't changed behavior in some forces in terms of driving people out of the emergency rooms into community health centers and other health care venues that we have. And we have a lot of community health centers all around the state. And so, I think there's still better ways to do it. In terms of the economic impact, I think that's a valid and good question, but I think there's going to be a replacement vehicle that's going to have plenty of money in the system, I think, to keep our specialists, our trauma units and all that, because we went through that before early in the 2000s when we were losing our trauma centers and everything. I'm hopeful that this will be better for everybody, including those healthcare providers who provide a lot of economic benefit.
Inshallah, as they say, God willing.
Exactly.
As a senator, you're going to be one of the 100 people who have a say in confirming President Trump's cabinet picks, judicial nominees. Have you seen anything so far in any of his picks that concerns you?
I've been fascinated watching this. I think it's different than I've ever remembered it being. Because the who's going to be our next, Secretary of Education, the first thing you see is a tweet that comes out. Well, it may be da-da-da-da-da. It's almost like a trial balloon. I don't remember ever having that kind of preview of who the pick is, and then all of a sudden, oh, guess what? That's the pick.
The Apprentice, sort of.
I was counting on Gary Busey, Secretary of State. And I'm kind of bummed out about that.
Yeah, the procession of people in and out of Trump
In and
Tower
out. You have to go by the, all the cameras, where I think a lot of it was done in private before. In a way, I think I'm pleased with who I've seen. I know Tom Price, who's going to be HHS. He's a physician. I served with him for 10 years in the Congress. He's a very smart person who knows the healthcare system. I know Secretary Chow. She's very capable. She was labor secretary for a long time. I think she's going to put together a really good infrastructure bill with the president, and she's going to obviously know how to work the Congress at it since she's married to Senator McConnell. I think Jeff Sessions, I've served with, that's going to have some fireworks, I think, at the hearing, because he's very Southern and he's a very strict constitutionalist. But he's also a very nice person who's built a lot of relationships across the line, even though he has philosophical differences with a lot of people, because he is really one of the more conservative members in the Senate. Secretary of State, I met Rex Tillerson one time, had a dinner with him, and we talked about energy. He talked about some of the carbon capture things that Exxon's involved in and some of the climate change issues that they're involved in. But I know him best, I think, for the dedication that he's had as a person to the Boy Scouts, because he's been a benefactor to the Bechtel Summit Reserve. So, those are some of the ones that I think are going to get a good vetting. It's going to be out in public. I think so far I've been really pleased with the choices. So it's kind of a variety.
How do you feel about the disclosures that Russia's had a hand in trying to influence the last election?
Well, I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned about, cybersecurity is something we should all be concerned about in every venue. Certainly elections, it's troubling. I think we'll have a full out investigation in the House and the Senate. I think we should. this time, supposedly it was supposedly, and I don't think we know all the answers here, to benefit President-elect Trump. Next time it could be to benefit my next opponent or whoever. So, I mean, I think it's an equal opportunity threat. But I think it's more this, and I'm not into this, but fake news and media and all these kinds of other driven sources that we never really had before. So I think we ought to get to the bottom of it and find out what was really going on.
And Senator, we feel we have a role here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting to try to provide people with just the facts and the truth. And yet sometimes it's really hard to compete with news that confirms people's biases, or it's very sensational and therefore it's something that they want to share. You know, it can be very hard to compete.
It is too, and I think that the insatiable need for breaking news, everything has to be right out there, right? It kind of pushes that. It pushes certainly in the commercial space, in the media. It pushes people who are watching their channel or listening to their channel. And I think that may push the news makers a little bit too.
And there's holy Twitter, Batman.
Yeah. Do you use Twitter?
Sparingly.
Sparingly.
Do you tweet?
Well, my official office and my campaign office tweet for me, but I watch Twitter all day. I enjoy it. I will say this. I retweeted something one time a long time ago by mistake because I pushed the old button, the wrong button.
We've all been there.
Yes.
Then so yes. No one do on Twitter either.
No, and I received an email from my chief of staff who informed me that they had changed the password. And I was no longer on.
So somebody else might need some help in that direction, too.
Yeah, I think you're right. I can't believe they haven't gotten the Twitter account out of his hands. Do you think he does it himself? I would be inclined to believe that he does, at least. I know. I think so.
Well, you know, it's funny. Doesn't everybody need somebody to tell them that what they did was a bad idea, or what they're planning to say is a bad idea? I hope Melania or somebody is helping to do that for him.
That's what spouses are often for.
That's what, his spouse is doing.
Or his daughter.
His daughter really seems to be the one that weighs a huge influence on him. But, you know, he got elected by turning up the heat. And I think it's reflected in his victory tour that he's going around, and I saw a clip of him on the TV the other day, maybe it was today, and he said, well, these crowds are kind of, after the election, they're not as excited, and they're not as, and I'm like, you know, the show's over, buddy, it's time to lead.
Time to do the work.
It's time to do the work.
Closer to home, both your son and your nephew are going to be freshman delegates here in the West Virginia legislature in January, and that's a position that you were in yourself 20 years ago at the start of your political career. Have you given them any advice?
Well, I'm certainly really proud of both of them, and my son Moore, who lives here in Charleston, we talk all the time. My advice to him is sit in the back row and listen, make friends, and I said, don't just make friends with the delegates. Make friends with the people who run the place, because that's who, you know, if you get into a little stick in the mud there, that's who you're going to want to have help you with procedure, help to figure out where and how you want to be most effective. What I'm most excited about is just having young people wanting to be in the process. West Virginia is at a crossroads. We need to take it as an opportunity to make change, take some risks, and I hope. You know, it's easy to say take risks when you're kind of on the outside. Look, once you get in, it becomes more difficult. You know, you've worked with the legislators. And I hope that spirit of youth and dedication to sort of let's turn it around allows them to continue to take risks. I'm really excited for both of them.
Who's your nephew?
Riley Moore from Shepherdstown. And then my son's more Capito, so we're just going to confuse everybody. We're not very creative with our names.
What's it like to be a mother watching your son run for the same office as you ran?
Well, have you ever watched a soccer game with your kid? You know, if you're playing soccer, it's different, or tennis, or swimming, or whatever. It doesn't make you quite so nervous. When you're watching your child do it, it's like, ooh, And I was like that. I remember when he came home from waving with his sign the first couple days. And he said, oh, I got a lot of good waves, a lot of good waves. But I had one guy that gave me the one finger salute. And I, you know, that's the one you remember. You always remember that one. And I said, you know, you got to, luckily our family, we've been through a lot publicly and politically, obviously with me, but also with my father, as you know. And we've got pretty tough skins. So I think he's going to be able to deflect it. He can give as good as it gets, I can tell you that.
So you're not an evil Little League parent then, right?
No.
And then going back to the campaigning, I think it's keeping track of the honk to middle finger ratio is really important when you're campaigning.
So I was told that you and Lori might have some sort of college connection.
Yes, Duke grad.
Right.
Only Duke grad in the Senate, which is awesome.
Yeah.
From West Virginia.
I loved my years at Duke.
It's and your great. Kids as well, right?
They all went there.
That's awesome.
And the only problem is Duke basketball is very much hated here in West Virginia, as you know.
There's a lot of Kentucky.
I kind of go down low on the cheering on my Blue Devils. But I guess Huggy's due to get his 800th win tomorrow, so that'll be a big day for the Mountaineers.
Yeah, we can pat them on the head and say
but
good job.
Duke's a great special place. I loved it.
Well, Senator, is there anything else that we forgot to ask you that you want to make sure got said?
No, I think that, you know, you read a lot about people are nervous or they're worried or they feel destitute because their person didn't win. I think if we could all just, I'm not saying all get along and, you know, sing kumbaya and give up, but I think if we could sort of take this as a time of a new beginnings, because it is a new beginning with a new president, a new governor, and say, let's just kind of hold back a little bit and find some good things that are happening. Doesn't mean you have to praise the person, but at least try to keep a little bit of the faith, especially around the holiday season and when so many people are hurting. We got to realize we got a lot of good things going on.
Senator Shelley Moore Capito, thank you for joining us on the front porch.
Thank you. Thanks.
And that's the front porch. Special thanks to Senator Capito, Rick Wilson, Lori Lynn, and our producer, Xander Alloy. Stay warm, and we'll see you next week.